This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org.
We is the champions.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Nintendo is back on top in the video game business. Today, a game magazine publisher said the Nintendo Wii outsold Sony's PlayStation 3 by more than 3-1 in Japan last month. In November, PlayStation actually outsold the Wii, but that's the only month it's done so since the two consoles were launched a year ago. You'll be hearing a lot about video gaming and wireless TV and GPS devices this week. The Consumer Electronics Show gets underway in Las Vegas today. Last night, Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates gave his traditional keynote speech. He predicted a second digital decade, one in which all of our devices will be connected and everything will be in HD, and people will interact with their gadgets differently.
Touch on Windows PC, touch on the iPhone. We started to see speech, the Tell Me capability built into the phone, the Ford Sync, where you get to talk and interact with your media or your phone capabilities. People are very interested in a simpler way of navigating the information.
By the way, this was Gates' last CES keynote address as Microsoft chairman. In July, he'll start working full-time on his foundation. There's a charity that helps folks in the entertainment industry. It's been around for more than a century, but a lot of people aren't aware of it. Might be a good time to check it out since thousands of writers are on strike. More now from Jeff Tyler.
Back in 1882, acting was not considered a respectable profession. Religious institutions denied actors charity, even refusing them proper burials. So the Actors Fund was established to provide emergency financial help to anyone in the industry. For example, the fund's Keith McNutt says that in 1888...
We helped two minstrels, one ballet girl, nine dancers, seven musicians, four stage managers, five circus performers...
These days, the Actors Fund faces a branding challenge.
The name, obviously, is a misnomer now.
Most of the people currently jobless due to the strike are not actors, but they can still tap the fund for financial aid.
We want everybody who works in entertainment to know that they can come if they're in financial crisis.
Most grants are for $500 to $1,000, though McNutt expects those figures will rise if the strike drags on. In Hollywood, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
I'm starting to get the feeling that McDonald's wants to be Starbucks and vice versa. The Wall Street Journal says McDonald's is planning to install coffee bars at about 14,000 of its restaurants. The coffee bars will be complete with cappuccinos, lattes, and baristas. McDonald's first step in taking on Starbucks was to offer a new premium coffee. In response, Starbucks started offering breakfast sandwiches. This is the Morning Report for Monday, January 7th on Marketplace.org. Tomorrow, New Hampshire voters will have their say in the presidential race. The candidates that are pushing economic populism might find tough sledding in New Hampshire. Jeremy Hobson explains.
Listen to these campaign pitches from some of the leading contenders for the presidency. Here's Democrat John Edwards.
When we speak up against corporate greed and for the 37 million Americans who live in poverty,
and here's Republican Mike Huckabee.
I connected with people on that level, talked about the importance of the middle class, being more inclusive about small business where 80% of our jobs...
Well, that message may have helped each candidate to some degree in Iowa, but New Hampshire has one of the lowest poverty rates in the country. It has one of the highest median incomes, and it's among the lowest in terms of uninsured citizens. Ross Cattell is an economist at the University of New Hampshire.
It's a relatively strong economic state, and some of the economic concerns and fears are not as pronounced here in New Hampshire as they are in other states.
Republican voter Suzanne Spencer of Plainfield says she does care about the little guy, but an economic populist might lose her support because of other issues.
Well, anyone's social platform is very important to me. I mean, I am pro-choice, but I'd have to see.
For Democrat Lori Santora of Bath, economic populism resonates. But she says foreign policy is just as important.
I think the war in Iraq probably has skewed that because we all have to be thinking foreign policy.
Candidates hoping to cash in on economic distress may have an easier time in states like Michigan and South Carolina, but they'll have to get through the New Hampshire primary first. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Are the presidential candidates addressing your concerns? Tell us about it. Just go to marketplace.org and click on Election 2008. U.S. passports have gone high-tech recently. They have chips embedded in them for better security and for getting through lines faster. Mexico is also trying something similar now. From our America's desk at WLRN, Dan Gretsch has more.
While the immigration debate roils in the U.S., Mexico has its own border problem at its southern frontier. The 200-plus crossings into Belize and Guatemala are plagued with falsified documents, corrupt border guards, and illegal immigrants. So Mexico's come up with a high-tech solution, an electronic identity card.
This is part of their program of trying to regularize with a database the people that are crossing the border. I think it's a very good step.
That's Lee Tabluski, director of Project Mexico at the Institute of the Americas. He says right now tourists and guest workers use a pase local, or local entry card.
People call these cards Mickey Mouse cards. They look bad. You can tell immediately that they're false, and they're all over the place. And this is an attempt with a chip to reduce or eliminate that kind of fraud.
The new electronic cards will be issued starting in March. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Texans who live on the border with Mexico have been given an ultimatum from the Department of Homeland Security. Landowners have to give the government access to their land to build a border fence or else. Or else they'll get dragged into federal court, or else they might lose their land entirely. From Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, David Martin Davies reports.
Eloisa Tomez traces her family back to the 1700s when the King of Spain granted her ancestors a parcel of land.
That part there used to be where my grandmother lived.
Over the generations, the family sold off most of that land, but Tomez still hangs on to a three-acre plot in Calabos, Texas, a rural community near the southernmost tip of the state and right in the path of the border fence. But Tomez says she's not selling her land to the government or anyone else.
There is no price tag. This is something I want to will to my children and to their children.
Tomez might not have a choice. Last month, the Army Corps of Engineers sent 135 letters to holdout landowners saying they want permission to access their land, survey it, and build the border fence by the end of the year. The government would pay fair market value for the land, and if need be, they would take the land under eminent domain. David Hall, the director of Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid, says some landowners gave their permission, but many, like Tomez, are saying no.
People at the other end of the spectrum say, we don't want to have anything to do with you. We've lived here in this family for 400 years. We're not going to give up anything. We'll fight you tooth and nail.
Hall is representing those holdout landowners against the federal government. He says a problem for the feds will be figuring out who exactly owns the land.
It's what we refer to around here in the legal business as a landman's nightmare.
Hall says some of these properties have never been surveyed. They've never had a title search. They've just been handed down from father to son for hundreds of years outside the legal system.
And the government's got to make sure they're dealing not only with the person in possession, but also whoever's got some claim to this land. It's going to be huge. It's going to be time-consuming. It's complicated.
But will that slow down the border fence? Not likely. Homeland Security can just take the land, begin construction, and worry about the court fights later. In San Antonio, I'm David Martin Davies for Marketplace.
I'm Scott Jagow, and this is the Morning Report on Marketplace.org. The polar bear could go on the U.S. government's endangered species list this week, and that could have some business implications. Danielle Carson has more from Washington.
Environmentalists say the designation can help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Andrew Wetzler is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Protecting the polar bear will be an enormous step forward towards saving the polar bear and will be an extraordinarily important recognition of the effect that global warming is having on the Arctic.
Once a species is declared endangered, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service develops a roadmap to protect it, says spokeswoman Valerie Fellows.
And there will be goals associated with that timeline and how we measure success.
Fellows wouldn't say whether government could use the endangered designation to mandate a cut in emissions, but the NRDC's Wetzler says federal agencies have to run safety checks on all permits.
Not only is that going to be activities such as oil and gas drilling or industrialization in the Arctic, but will also embrace federal actions that are exacerbating global warming.
The Endangered Species Act rarely stops projects, but does call on agencies to take common sense measures to protect wildlife. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace.
Wall Street has started the year off in a hole. The Dow begins the week well below 13,000. It lost 500 points last week. The S&P 500 is at 1411 after losing more than 4% in the first week of the year. The NASDAQ is at 2504. Things only got worse in Asia today. Stocks slid more than 2%. European shares are up a fraction, though. Last year wasn't the best year for the stock market. The S&P 500 stocks gave investors half their historical returns.
And now it's time for the Sloan Sessions.
Fortune magazine's Alan Sloan has been perusing the numbers from 2007, and he found these trends. Growth stocks did better than value stocks for the first time in a while. Big companies outperformed smaller ones for the first time in a while. And foreign stocks pummeled U.S. stocks. Okay, Alan, let's break those down. Why did growth stocks do better than value?
All right, one reason is that value stocks were doing terribly. A lot of them are the financial stocks, and the financial stocks got clobbered, and for good reason, as we know, because of all the problems in the debt market. And growth is technology, and technology, largely technology, and technology did very well.
Now, what about the trend with small companies versus big companies?
Normally, small companies trade for less than big companies compared to earnings and the stated value. But over the past few years, as people like me sat there with what they call small caps, things got out of whack. And the small caps, in many ways, at the beginning of last year, were trading for higher ratios than the mid caps of the bigger things. And life has reasserted itself as it always does. And everything that had been true in previous years had all reversed.
And does that include foreign stocks versus U.S. stocks?
No, foreign stocks have been doing better for quite a while against U.S. stocks. And foreign is, I mean, so much better. It's a combination of the companies doing better and the dollar weakening, because if you're investing in companies that keep books in currencies other than the dollar, every time the dollar drops, they do better in dollar terms than a company like a U.S. company that keeps scoring dollars.
So, Alan, based on what you've said, what you've discovered about the trends of last year, how does that affect your investing for 2008?
What I'm probably going to do, hating myself every minute, is I'm going to switch probably even more money from U.S. stock funds into foreign stock funds. I've already cut back a lot on my small cap funds, and I'm just going to hope that, you know, things work out. But boy, they sure didn't work out last year. It was a really mediocre and crummy year for stocks.
Here's to a better 2008.
Thank you, Scott. And maybe next year we'll talk about how much money we all made.
In Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.